Hogan David wine is like the pretty standard one. It's like really sweet, like red wine.
Why did they not stop a 12-year-old from drinking the wine?
it's the blood of Christ. So yeah. It's good for you. Yeah. You know?
Fair enough.
You know, so if you get to a real fancy Lutheran church, you're gonna have white wine or red wine, you choose.
Wow.
Don't know why they feel the need to differentiate, but they do. So yeah, I grew up in the church and I feel like my relationship with God is ebbs and flows, you know, as any relationship's going to ebb and flow, but I leaned on him a lot during my time. I mean, I'll never forget, like, when I was in New York City, like Wall Street, literally 20 years old, interviewed for Deutsche Bank and then didn't get the job. And I was just like, why God? Like, what is going on?
Mm-hmm.
And so over time, I kind of like, you know, I could brush it off quickly and other opportunities that came through. But like, he's always provided for me, and every opportunity is truly like, not rejection, but redirection towards what God has in store for you. I do genuinely believe that. And so it's hard to always trust him and everything. You know, you, as a human, you kind of forget, like, he's going to take care of you. But then Romans 5:6 is, I believe, at just the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. And that,
say that again.
At just the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. Yeah. And I could botch that, but it's the gist. Okay. It's pretty similar, nearly verbatim. And the reason I love that verse so much is because it just reminds me of God's timing is perfect. It's just the right time. Just the right time.
This episode is sponsored by Tin Can Timepieces. Looking for a watch that's built for anything life throws at you? Let me introduce you to Tin Can Timepieces. This is more than just a watch. It's a commitment to quality and purpose. Tin Can Timepieces is proudly based out of Georgia and is owned and operated by an active-duty U.S. Navy submariner. That's right. A company built on discipline and precision. Every watch they create is handcrafted and features reliable automatic movements, ensuring you get a premium quality feel with every tick. Whether you need a rugged diver or a classic dress watch, Tin Can offers an assortment of styles for every mission. Tin Can Timepieces. Hand-built for purpose, built for the depths. Dive deeper and check out their collection today at tincantime.com.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Pod Staff. With me tonight, I have Mr. Tom Kurtzinger. Yep. So, Tom, thank you for being here, man.
Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it.
So, Tom is actually in from Miami. He flew all the way to Texas to do this episode. So, we're going to have a great time tonight and hopefully share some pretty cool stuff. So, Tom is actually a finance guy. So, he's, you know, worked in finance for some pretty major companies. So just tell us a little bit about your background.
Yeah, so I started my career at Southern Glazer's Wine and Spirits. They're the largest alcohol distributor in the U.S. And when I worked for Southern, I worked on the Bacardi brands. So I ended up moving over to Bacardi at a certain point in my career. And right now, in addition to having my own company, I work for Galderma. And Galderma owns brands like Cetaphil, Nemluvio, Differin. I work on the Cetaphil and Differin brands.
Yeah.
So that was great. But mostly my background's in consumer packaged goods. Like even at Bacardi, it's not just Bacardi. It's Grey Goose, Bombay, Angels Envy, Patron.
Yeah. All brands that we know.
Yeah. And love.
So cosmetics and liquor.
Cosmetics and liquor.
That's a
and
good
distribution,
one.
Yeah.
That's awesome, dude.
Yeah.
So talk to me a little bit about your move to Miami, because you're a Kentucky guy.
Yeah,
right?
Born and raised in Louisville. So yeah. Actually Shepherdsville, if you know Shepherdsville, then you know. But it's a suburb of Louisville, grew up there. Went to school at Morehead State University, which is how we connected through Allie, your girlfriend. And so that was my first like time not living at home. And then I was there for 3 years, graduated, went back to Louisville, was there for 3 or 4 years, really 2019 through 2023. And then I moved to Miami for Bacardi in 2023, yeah, August. And so then I've lived there ever since. And now I'm debating, do I stay in Miami or do I move back home to Kentucky or do I move over to where I'd love to live, which is the Northeast?
Yeah.
So got some options.
So, yeah. So you're planning on potentially leaving Miami.
Yeah. I always knew I'd end up in Miami because at Southern, right, like their headquarters is in Miami and Dallas. And then, you know, for career progression, it was like the field roles outside of Florida, Texas, and California were pretty small. And Kentucky's a tier two state, which there's like three tiers, tier one, tier two, and tier three. It's a small tier two. So tier ones would be like California, Texas, Illinois, that kind of major, major states.
Yeah.
And so there's not a lot of opportunity. There is an adult beverage, but not at Southern specifically.
Right.
And then I love Bacardi. My mentor, she worked there. That's how I met her, when she actually worked at Bacardi. And then I was just an employee at Kroger. I was 16.
Yeah.
And Bacardi is, they have their U.S. headquarters in Miami. So I was like, okay, Coral Gables. So I was like, I'll probably end up moving there. And I didn't want to. And then they offered me a job. And the condition was, we want you to move in a year. So when I got the job, I had like a 12-month timeline before I had to move to Miami. And now I'm there. And it's a huge adjustment. I would say if you ever are considering living abroad, you definitely want to live in Miami first, because it's going to give you that international experience without living abroad officially.
Yeah, because I feel like it's funny that you say you're thinking about like where you're going to live next, because I feel like most people, especially if you're from Kentucky or somewhere that's just like totally different from Miami, and you're trying to go to Miami, you're going there, like that's your goal. Like you want to go there and like live the big life and stuff like that.
Yeah, you definitely want to live your best life in Miami. I mean, it's so much fun. It's always loud. There's always something going on. Someone's always somewhere. Mm-hmm. And when I first moved there, I definitely went to like all the big clubs except for Space and did all the fun things. And I still try to go to as many like drink spots and dinner spots as possible and really explore the city, because there's just so much to offer, and you know, people are flying in to go do it. But like the first year, I was a member of a beach club and did that whole thing for a while, and you know, did the scenes and stuff, and I had a lot of fun. But it's definitely a city where the what you do can eat you alive financially. Drinks are expensive, food is expensive, going out, just like being a member at a place is expensive, everything's expensive. So this last, I would say, 12 months has been more like subdued and relaxed, and kind of just getting drinks on the weekends or dinner on the weekends with some friends.
Yeah, I bet you. But I feel like whenever you get there, you have to do all the experiences.
Yeah, I mean, you know, anytime you live in a big city, you don't want to live in the burbs at first, because you move to the city. Why would you ever do that? You know, if you live in New York, why would you live in Brooklyn first? I'd live in Manhattan, you know? Yeah. Then for the first year, get the experiences in New York or in Miami, and then you can move out. But I live right in between the airport and downtown, so I get the best of both worlds. I'm close to two major interstates, so I can get on and off quickly, and I can get to Fort Lauderdale in like 35-40 minutes. The beach is in 15, the airport's in 8 minutes. So I have a really good setup, and I've just never really decided to move past that, because traffic is such a bear in Miami. I mean, you're talking like a commute to the office when I worked in Coral Gables. Without traffic, it's 15 minutes. With traffic, it's 40.
Yeah.
So, and I'm in a good spot, like location-wise.
Right.
And if you don't live that close to downtown, it just becomes insane. I mean, I know many people, coworkers, travel 2 hours to go to work.
That is like one way?
One way, yeah.
That's nuts.
Yeah. So
I'm 45 minutes right now, and that's with like leaving early and, you know, in the morning, and then leaving early in the afternoon as well. And that's still like, yeah, that's kind of pushing my max. Like, I don't want to drive an hour plus to work.
No, I don't either. And when you think about everything else you want to do throughout the day, you're talking like, oh, I want to go to the gym and like hang out with my wife or my girlfriend or whoever, my friends, go to dinner at night. That's 2 hours of your day you have to sacrifice that you could be working from home or having a shorter commute.
Right.
And so when I left Bacardi and worked for Galderma, their offices are in Brickell. And so Brickell is the major like downtown area, and it's only 15 minutes away. Mm. So I cut my commute time almost, actually more than half, from Coral Gables to Brickell, and it's close to interstates, and there's a lot of stuff that you can do downtown, and it's really convenient. Like, I work out down there, so I enjoy it now.
Yeah.
You got to find your niche.
Yeah. No, that's cool. So I want to move into like your career experience first. Yeah. So tell me about like some of the... we had talked a little bit about the just kind of the BS that you had to deal with.
Yeah.
Like coming into an industry like totally bright eyed, like, mm-hmm. This has been my dream to work for a company like this. And then kind of having that like rude awakening of, wow, this kind of sucks.
Yeah. I think it goes back like even before, because I didn't want to go into adult beverage. Not really. In the beginning, I wanted to be an investment banker, mm-hmm. for a really long time, which I think, if you're ever like a young guy and you're ambitious in finance, it's kind of, you know, you want to be on like the sexy side of finance, which is trading and investment banking and all those like really cool like Wall Street type things. Mm-hmm. But so I pursued that, and then I ended up getting job offers at Goldman Sachs and Deutsche Bank. And the pay was too low at Goldman because it was in Germany. It was an internship. And so I turned it down, and then... which is crazy, because I'm like, this is Goldman Sachs. Like, how do you turn it down?
I've never heard of someone get a job offer from Goldman and
then turn it down. Yeah, I don't know. But that was me. And then the job at Deutsche was not, it was like investment banking adjacent. It was in corporate investment banking, like the business unit, but it was on the know your client side, so compliance. So it wasn't like super sexy, but it paid a lot of money, like so much money. And when you're 20 years old and you just interviewed on Wall Street for them and you're like, oh, I didn't get that job, but they want me to interview in Jacksonville. And you're like, okay, here's this other opportunity. And they fly you down and they have a driver pick you up in a nice Cadillac and they chauffeur you to the office and you're 20 years old and they take you out and the girl who takes you to lunch is 3 years older than you and has a $90,000 Range Rover. It's like, how do you not want to do this? And
yeah, then, like, how'd you get that? I want to get that.
Right. So I was like, this is tough. So I called some people in the airport on the way home and was like, I don't think I'm going to do this job. So that was like the first piece, is like, they work so much, all this BS, I don't want to do it, but I've reached my dreams. And so of like being in high finance and like, oh, I have these names. And I was so caught up on like proving myself through names. And I turned it down. That was a crazy like first part of like, whoa, what the hell? Like you kind of like shake your belief of who you are a little bit. But my mentor and very good friend, she worked for Bacardi. And so when we met, we just stayed in close contact throughout the years in college. And so she got me a job at Southern. She worked for Bacardi. Southern is the national distributor for Bacardi in the U.S. So she had really good connections, and there was a business analyst role opening up at Southern. And she's like, you know, I can help you get the job if you want. Like, happy to make the intro. And apparently the intro was so good, the guy said, like, I could not at least interview. It was a great one. So got the job, which is really fantastic. And, you know, you come out of college and you're so excited about being in corporate America, and you're like, oh, I want to crush it. You know, like I want to be so, so good. And I was definitely in a really weird environment there. Like, I love my time at Southern looking back, but it's definitely like, it can be pretty toxic at times. And it depends on your team, of course. It's never like the overall company is that way, but the team I was on was just not great. Like, a lot of like corporate bullying as a like a young guy. Like she bought me all these really nice.
Give me an example.
Like, okay, so when I first started, and let me just frame it. Like, I'm sure I deserve part of this bullying because as a young, like arrogant 20-year-old kid who thinks they know all the things in the world, and you're not bossing, you're like informing people who are in their 40s about like, you should make this decision because the data says this.
Yeah, but did you deserve it though? I mean, I think that's another like mental side of it. It's like, did you rationalize it potentially in some ways and say, I probably had it coming? Because I think we do that a lot as just people who are like decent people. We're like, yeah, you know, I look back and I think, wow, I was a really crappy person at this period in my life. And it's like, on the surface, I probably did really crappy things at times.
Yeah.
But I wasn't a crappy person. But you look back and you're kind of hard on yourself on that.
Yeah. I mean, there's probably some things I'm rationalizing of like, you know, I kind of deserved it being this way. But in other ways, I'm sure I kind of did because I was a little, I needed to be like boxed in a little bit. You know what I'm saying? Like control and understand the flow of corporate America and like, you know, the feedback I would get is like, you're a little arrogant, blah, 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 blah. So like, okay, I get it. You know, like boxing. But some things were just really nitpicky feedback of like, why give me that? But for example, I had all of these polos and like vests and jackets embroidered with like the Bacardi brands. Bacardi, Grey Goose, Patron. And I didn't do it myself. Like my mentor, Lindsay, did, which was super, like, very generous. So first, you have to do that, you know.
Right.
But she's like, you work on the Bacardi brands. You should rep the brand that you work for. It's very common in the industry to do that. And they're cool logos and stuff. And so occasionally my boss and his boss would be like, oh, where'd you get that? I'm like, oh, Lindsay bought it for me. And they were jealous of my relationship with Lindsay. And then because of the role she had at Bacardi and this, like she was a very like, high performer and everything. And so one time I walked into a conference room and they were like, where'd you get that vest? And it had like a Grey Goose logo or whatever. And I was like, oh, like Lindsay bought it for me.
Yeah, once again.
And yeah. And they were like, yeah, so like, we're not jealous. And like, we think it's cool you got that. We're like, I wouldn't wear that in the office anymore because, you know, other people on the team don't have those kind of things. But again, we're not jealous. And these are like 42, 44-year-old men telling me this. And I'm like, really? You're going to nitpick me on a...
Yeah,
a thing that's in dress code and that you already have all this stuff anyway, and I'm getting more like custom things because not everybody has it. But again, everybody has something very similar. So that was one thing I went through, you know.
It's like saying, hey, don't wear your North Face because everyone here can only kind of afford like, you know, Walmart brand stuff. But so like, you're not allowed to wear that anymore. It's like,
right.
These are just clothes.
Yeah, exactly. And then one time I was in Vegas and we had a national sales meeting. And so we're all out there and I got the invite, which is really great. I had just got my promotion. So I was a commercial, I was a business analyst for one state. And then I was a commercial finance manager for two. So I had Kentucky and South Carolina, same business unit, transatlantic. And so the Bacardi brands. And I was at, we were just standing there talking around and had gone shopping that day. And like, I wanted to get some nice stuff because it was COVID. So like, you know, bonuses were through the roof. Everybody's drinking, you know, everyone's like, oh yeah, 150% bonuses. Let's live it up. So I bought some nice merch from a couple of designers. Again, you're in Vegas, right? It's the designer shops. Like, cool, I'm gonna get some things. Well, news had got back to my boss, and I had a new boss at this point. Same division, new boss, different team. And she's like, yeah, I don't know how you can afford that because I know how much you make. And it's like, that's not really in your business, but right. I could be a trust fund baby for all you know.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, that's just
kind of...
No, unfortunately, I'm not... not
that would be
like
pretty
that.
Nice, yeah.
I wish, but, you know, there's a lot of that kind of thing. Some of the feedback of, like, you know, one time I wrote an email about like our annual operating plan and, you know, the GM of the state, so the big guy who like led Kentucky, was asking for all these files because my role is directly responsible for like manufacturing, or not manufacturing, but like publishing the file, putting all the inputs in, mm-hmm. publishing it for the business. And so I responded in a very like me focused email, like a lot of I's and me's. And because again, I'm directly responsible for delivering the AOP in this capacity, the mm-hmm. annual operating plan in this capacity. And I got a phone call from the GM, not the state leader, but like my business unit GM in Kentucky. And he's like, yeah, so like, I don't know, but you know, I got a call and like this email came on very arrogant and you know, it's not just yours. Come to find out, I mean, like it was definitely the guy calling me, right? Like, and he had the problem with it. And he would give me a lot of like very like father figure esque advice that really wasn't warranted. But it came from a good place. I would like to think it came from a good place,
yeah.
But he definitely would give and my old boss too, the one who I had in the very beginning, they were definitely, just a little bit, I would say, strict and like very intense feedback and very manipulative feedback. And so, you know, I would like go to work and like cry in the car because I'm like, I'm so stressed out yeah. about going to work and like I can't have anything wrong. And they didn't understand the limitations of Excel. And so they make you try to do these crazy trackers because in the adult beverage industry, especially on the distributor side, everyone's incentivized. Like all your pay, like you have a very minimal like base pay. And then you get a ton of extra incentives on top mm-hmm. to help you encourage you on which brands to sell in a given month and that kind of
right.
thing. So in Excel, like you have a lot of limitations. And so I would tell them, I hear you on what you want to do with this tracker, but I legit can't. It got so bad one time that I like legit started crying in the office because my boss, this is like very early on, and I'm like not a crier, but he was so aggressive and like such an ass to me over this email thread and like was basically yelling in the email that his boss had to walk across the hall, like the other side of the building, and be like, hey, like don't respond to that email anymore. It's like totally gone out of control. And mind you, like there's more than just me, my boss, and his boss on the thread. It's a whole other chain team.
Wow, it's like you're dealing with a bunch of children on a large, well-known liquor stage.
Yeah,
you know? And how long did that go on? Because I feel like if I have had pretty decent experiences with work and like mm-hmm. like at least enjoying from a work standpoint going to work.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine going longer than, you know, a few weeks with having those feelings going into the office every single day.
Yeah, so I was on that exact team. So my first boss ever at Southern, he left the business unit, I would say about a year in, because I started in June. No, not even. He left 7 months in. Probably about a year. I would say a year, because I started in June, he left in COVID, and he went to a different business unit. And then the guy I backfilled actually became my boss. And he's been great. Like, we went to Australia together. Him and his wife and I are super close.
Yeah.
Just the best guy you could ever ask for as a manager. So life improved dramatically. And he became a buffer between me and the GM. We had a really good relationship. And I felt like a partner with him versus an employee. Mm. And it was like, in the beginning, you fall in line. And you don't question what I'm telling you. You just do it and you figure it out. Whereas with the new manager, he was super chill and was like, you know, I understand you're human and I want to work on this together. And he's like, what's your thought on this versus do this? Mm-hmm. But I will say, I would not be where I'm at today without my first two bosses. In fact, like some of the feedback I would get is, you don't color code your commentary, or you don't add color to your Excel files enough. And like nitpick you and like be like, no, go do it again because this isn't like color coded or this isn't this. Yeah. And it would all be like, oh, we're trying to help you like grow as a person and a leader and blah, 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 blah. Yeah. I will say that those really nitpicky details and things they call you out on have actually helped me a ton stand out from the crowd because the attention to detail does help. But the way they would go about the feedback was just very immature.
Well, I mean, yeah, I think that's everything. Like, mm-hmm. I actually was just talking to my VP today. Mm-hmm. We were talking about, like, just bosses and stuff. I've always been like, you know, I had, especially for a company I worked for about 3 years, had really great leaders, you know, direct leaders as well. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about how he had a leader one time, and it was like, a bullpen environment where he was just screaming, cursing at everyone. And he's like, as much as I hated him and I hated that job, there is actually something I forget what it was, but he was like, there was something I thought of the other day that I did, and it's because of him. So it's like, I don't like the guy, but I got benefit in some way from him. So we were talking about like how there's different leaders. It's like some leaders want to win the heart before they tell you what to do. And some leaders are like, I know this needs to be done, so I'm going to make it happen. And unfortunately, we also get benefit from those leaders from, you know, little things like that, but also what we don't want to do in terms of treating people well. Yeah. I respond very well to, and this is my leadership style as well, to try to win the heart before you tell someone what to do. And the presentation is everything.
Yeah, and on the presentation, so I have a friend, they're in HR, and they were saying there's a couple of different ways to get feedback, but one that really resonated with me is framing it of, while we appreciate X or while I appreciate X, it could have been done better through Y, or that I'm probably botching the actual like delivery after the while I appreciate. Mm-hmm. But the big one is like, you frame it as, hey, I really understand what you did and I value what you did because you tried and you did a good job, or you just did a job. But here's where we can do better because there's always room
for improvement. It's a compliment leading into a criticism.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So it's like you're almost like preparing them emotionally for what's to come so that they receive it well. So it's like, oh, thanks. That's awesome. And then you drop the criticism on them. They're like, oh, that's cool. And I'm going to walk out of here knowing what to do better. And then also feeling kind of good about myself because they saw the effort that I put in. So
yeah. And, you know, when I was at Bacardi my first couple months, they were bigger on like, you know, let's have a book. We'll read it once a quarter and we'll connect in our quarterly meetings and we'll discuss it.
Like a self-help book or leadership book or something like that.
And so the first one was about Netflix, The No Rules Rule, I think is the name of the book. And part of it was Radical Candor, which is funny because the person who made us read that book cannot handle Radical Candor themselves. But you learned a lot about feedback in general, right? So at Netflix, they have a policy of, let's say, Michael, you didn't do something I liked. I would come up to you and say, you know, I really did not appreciate that you called me out in the meeting like that. Like, that's just not professional. And then you kind of move on. Mm-hmm. It's like all about like being honest. Or like, hey, you, your Excel file looked pretty sloppy. And, you know, we can actually fix it through X, Y, Z reason. And so it was not about being rude, but also but really focusing on delivering the feedback when it's relevant and from a place of working to improve
solutions.
Right.
Right.
Now, the big piece I learned was about feedback from that book is you're going to get feedback from everybody no matter what. It doesn't matter if you solicited it or you didn't solicit it. But the important piece is to recognize where that feedback comes from that individual and who that person is. And then you can hear it. You should always hear it. You should thank them for the feedback because it can be difficult to give feedback. And you should give feedback up and down the chain of command. It should not always be just down to the bottom. It should also go up because it's an important ecosystem. That's how they talk about it in the book at Netflix. But it's okay to dismiss feedback. Not like in the moment, right? Of like, well, thanks, but no thanks. But you take it, you digest it, and then you can decide, is that feedback really relevant?
Well, and I think that ties into directly. I had a podcast guest on here, and she told me, I quote, your opinion is none of my business. Like, right. Your opinion of me, I think that's what it is. Your opinion of me is none of my business. So it's like, that's where you can dismiss. It's like someone comes off rude, or maybe they say something that, you know, maybe that's their opinion, but you know that that's not feedback you're going to take.
Right.
It's like, you don't have to get mad or get sad about it or whatever. Like, it takes work, but thinking, your opinion of me is none of my business, that's a great way to just be like, yeah, maybe I need to work on some things, but and that's okay. Appreciate it.
Yeah, you know, like, for example, when I had read that book, I left Southern, and I looked back on my time there and the feedback I had received, and was like, at the time I didn't have the the insight to say thank you for your feedback, walk away, and then just dismiss it. I took it so, like, personally, because I was so, I wanted to be so great at what I did, and I still have that feeling, but I didn't have a lot of confidence. And so negative feedback or constructive criticism really hit me deep, and it just chipped away at my confidence over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And then on the personal side of things too, like, there was stuff happening in my life that I wasn't in the right headspace to
receive it. Right.
And that's super important. And so all these things together led me to just shrink up inside and not be in a good spot. And I wish I had known and read that book to be like, you don't have to take that feedback. Like, it's very important. You shouldn't always dismiss feedback. You should seek it out actively. And that book even says it, but you should know when feedback is relevant and when feedback isn't relevant, because you often have haters.
Yeah.
And they're going to give you feedback more than people who are your fans.
And the better you do in life, the more haters you have. Oh, I mean, 100%. I've already had some haters on this podcast, and it's like, bring it on. Like, seriously, haters, bring it on, because it just fuels the fire. And I don't think the haters understand that that's what they're doing, but it's almost like laughable, but it's also like, actually, it's not screw you. It's like, thank you.
Yeah,
it's
thank
like,
you.
Thank you, because this is helping
me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very much so.
So I want to go back to one thing. Last thing I want to talk about in terms of like the corporate stuff and everything like that is just kind of like the golden handcuffs. You had mentioned briefly earlier that the base salary in those industries is usually pretty low, and then you get more like incentive type stuff.
Yeah.
And we were talking about how a lot of that is like quarterly or yearly. So my question would be, because I've had different commission structures, like one every month, then every quarter, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I feel like those long commission cycles is like golden handcuffs that basically, like, if you're looking for a new job and you know you've got 3 months left until you're getting your commission, you could pass on an opportunity, but it's like, do you get the opportunity that you want? Do you go for that? Or do you wait it out and risk it and get the money? So I feel like I'd like to hear your perspective on that, because it seems very extreme in that industry.
Yeah, so I would say the pay is really good on the supplier side. It's a very different industry or different business model, right? The margins are so rich. I mean, you know, you can look at the public data, right? Like Diageo, Pernod, Ricard, Brown-Forman. Their margins are like 60% for gross margin. So very, very high. And then operating income is in the 30s or 40s, depending on the company. So they pay really well. And they're more tied to consumer packaged goods or CPG brands like Galderma or Mondelez. What's the other big one? I'm blanking on the name. Anyway, so they pay really well. Southern does not. So that was a big piece. You know, a big reason I left that company is because I was underpaid. Literally, I found out, my manager told me, you're under the band for the role. I don't know how you can even be underneath the band of the role, but you could at that company at least. So when I left, it was a 70% pay increase. But to tie back to...
Now you have a Cartier Santos on your wrist.
Yeah, that came definitely
I've got 10 can timepieces on my wrist, but you've got a Cartier Santos.
I'm going to get me one of those.
I think I like mine a little bit better. Yeah, shout out 10 can time.
There you go. So we... it was an easy decision to leave because the money was so much more. Like, even if I had not... And I did not get a sign-on bonus to go to Bacardi to offset my lost bonus at Southern. But the pay was so much more that it was a no-brainer. Why would I ever pass up an opportunity to earn 70% more money?
Yeah.
Because in 3 months, I'll make what I was going to make my bonus at 100% payout.
Right.
So, you know, whatever. But for when I went to Bacardi and I was making good money, and then I left to go to Galderma, a big thing is, you know, you are paid on an annual performance plan. And so with some companies, you have to be employed on the last day of the business year, like the fiscal year. So like Bacardi would be March 31st. and then you're eligible for payout even if you leave the company, which is really fantastic. Not every company does that. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, a Southern, I don't think if their last day is December 31st. Mm-hmm. I don't think if you're not around on March 31st or March 15th, pretty sure you don't get your bonus.
Right.
So you have to think about that.
You mean December 31st or
March? So they do their fiscal year closes on December 31st, right, and they pay out 90 days later.
Oh, so you're saying you have to be there when the payout goes. So
yeah,
you don't even if you've gotten the bonus for the whole year, you don't get that unless you stay for the payout date.
I'm pretty sure. No,
that sucks.
I could be wrong, but that's...
I'm sure. Well, I mean, even if you're wrong on that company, I'm sure that that exists a lot of places.
From my understanding, most companies are not generous like Bacardi, where, hey, if you're on the if you're with us on the last day of the fiscal year or the next or the first day of the next, we'll pay you out even if you left, yeah, you know, after that. But Galderma is not the same. So, you know, everyone's a little bit different, I think.
This episode is sponsored by Dive Fit. Dive Fit is a faith-based clothing brand rooted in Christ and built on consistency, structure, and personal growth. Dive Fit's mission is to help people show up stronger in their faith, their health, and their daily lives. Check out their collection today at die-fit.printify.me.
All right, man. So next I want to get into your business that you're starting. So
yeah.
Tom is not only a corporate finance guy, but he also is transitioning into an entrepreneur starting his own business. So the company is called Vantage Point, and I'm just going to let you spill it.
Yes. Yeah, so I started Vantage Point Consulting Group, is the full name, about 2 years ago. It's, you know, my family is a group of entrepreneurs off and on. And I was like, you know, I want to go into that space. And they always encourage us to go the corporate route first because it's just easier. You have a steady paycheck and it's just consistent. And being an entrepreneur is a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
So I was like, yeah, I'll do that. And then... I had a really tough time at Bacardi. We've talked about that. Mm-hmm. You know, I knew I was going to be probably fired. So I started looking at buying a business and was going down that path. And I had just enough money to buy a small business. Mm-hmm. And probably not a healthy business, but definitely a small business.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in my course of looking for 7 months, I kept seeing all these really, like, just desolate P&Ls, basically, and balance sheets. A P&L, profit and loss statement. Balance sheets and cash flows, and I'm like, these people have such, they could have really great businesses, but they run it like they run their own income. They treat their businesses, I just pull money from it, you know, because a lot of people think that, oh, my business makes money, it just pays. So you see a lot of mismanagement
instead of reinvesting. You mean
instead of reinvesting, like
people taking it, owners taking too high of salaries before, yeah, it gets to the point
their dog's on payroll, their mom's on payroll, so you know, it's all this stuff. Yeah. And they're expensing, you know, $8,000 in cleaning supplies, and it's really like some random person they're like paying on the table. So you see it and you're like, that sucks. And so then I was put on my performance improvement plan. And at that time I had walked away from potentially buying a business, but they had so much data. They had like the best chart of accounts, which is how you organize your profit and loss and your balance sheet and everything from an accounting perspective. So you get really, really strong data. We can talk about that later, but I was able to understand their business in a way that you typically do not get from a small business. Mm-hmm. And they paid for it. I mean, they paid $40,000 a year for their accountant. So it was like, you get really good data. So we had a really great conversation. And, you know, when I walked away, they're like, we'd love for you to consult. And I was like, you know, I actually wanted to do that. And that's what really started Vantage Point was, oh, well, all these small businesses need people who have this really strong corporate finance background to come in and teach them, because not only do I have commercial finance experience, which is a mixture of FP&A, financial planning and analysis, and revenue management, which is like pricing and promo and how do you price your product and how do you manage your product mix, so how you sell your products. But I had more business analytics work, and I've done commercial roles like trade development, which is planning sales and planning route to markets and product commercialization, innovation, all these different things. So I was like, I have this kind of really unique skill set that a lot of companies that are sub 10 million could use.
Now, what point, because I feel like that was a cool realization. And I don't want to skip over that quite yet, because I feel like how old are you now?
27.
Right. So a few years ago, yeah, you realized about yourself, hey, I've got this skill set that like, it, age doesn't factor here anymore. It's like, I have this skill set now. And I think that's a common thing, to where we think age, the skill set comes with age.
For
but
sure.
But really, I think it's as soon as you stop looking at yourself as I'm this age, so I should only be this, the world just opens up for you. And I want to hear about like that moment where you're like, oh, I don't actually have to buy a business.
Yeah.
I can help all these businesses.
Yeah, it was, it really was just seeing all the mismanagement of these organizations and thinking to yourself, and it takes a little bit of arrogance. Maybe there was a common theme back at Southern when I was getting that feedback, you know?
Yeah. Hey, at least you're honest and humble about it now.
You know, you got to have a little bit of arrogance. I heard this at a small business owner conference. You got to have a little bit of arrogance to do what we do. Because it's
especially
true.
Especially when you're a finance bro.
Yeah, I mean, it comes with the territory. But
you got to have a Cartier or a Rolex.
Yeah,
and then you got to
have the cars. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It comes. It's just part of it. You know, you learn that in one of your college classes. So, but, you know, I sat there and was like, I don't understand how there's people who have these really successful businesses, or, you know, on paper, they're making $1 million, $3 million, $4 million a year in revenue, and they're generating, you know, 10% profit or whatever, and they could do so much more. And it's like, how do you not see that? Why do you not understand? And it's because people are really just not, they get very uncomfortable when it comes to finance and accounting. It's just like archaic language to them, or like it's alien, and they get really scared, and there's a lot of really intense terms.
Do you think they get scared a lot because since they don't know it, they know that someone could do it wrong and they wouldn't notice?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think
I would be scared of that. Yeah,
I think so, because a lot of people trust their accountants with everything, and these people, they don't really know them. You know, you have an accountant, you talk to them once a month, whatever. But where I think a lot of it comes from is all the terms. Finance itself, especially high finance, like investment banking, the terms are like prohibitive, right? Like, think of when I was going to work in...
what do you mean?
So when I was going to work in the corporate bank side of Deutsche Bank, the team I was going to work on was called LDCM, so Leveraged Debt Capital, LDCM, Leveraged Debt Capital Markets. And so it sounds real fancy and everything, but it just means you have risky debt and you're working on the market in which those resources exist, right? So capital is just funds. Leverage debt is just risky debt. It's, you know, you have a lot of debt against it.
Mm-hmm.
Market just being like the open area where you purchase it. Right. So it sounds prohibitive because it's like, oh, it's scary. Like, what the hell is LDC and leverage debts? Or, oh, we have a leverage buyout. Like, that's, what's a leverage buyout? Or, you know, oh, you have a convertible note. All these things that are kind of scary, and people walk away from it. They're like, oh, I don't know. Because it's intimidating.
Right, so they don't know, so they...
They just shy away.
Yeah, I can understand that, though. I mean, for your average person, even your average business owner, like, I feel like I know a lot of people who have their own businesses, and they don't do their own accounting. They don't know all these terms that you're throwing out here.
And as a result, you know, you have these accountants, and we don't just do accounting, but you have these accountants who just book a very basic chart of accounts, and they slap your data in there. They don't talk to you. They just code it as it comes in the bank feed. They don't ask for receipts. They don't really spend time thinking through it on an accrual basis versus cash. Yeah, it's not methodical. And so when you have a strong accountant come in, or someone who's been in finance previously, who is knows enough about accounting to be dangerous and also can do accounting, have done it, you can start getting really good data. Because think about it. If you're a small business, you know, you're not buying Circana data or Nielsen data to understand the marketplace, right? That's big corporations like Procter & Gamble buys that. Bacardi, Southern Glazers buy that data. For a small business, you can buy Beiser data, which is Nielsen's small business package.
Mm-hmm.
But one category, not even a category, yeah, one like subset of a category. So if you think of spirits as the industry, a category would be gin. One package, a small one for gin, would be $10,000, $8,000 for just 10 pulls. So it's very expensive.
So what does that get you? Like
so much.
Equate,
you know,
that to...
Like, you're talking retailer data across whatever market you want to look at. You know, Nielsen's countrywide. And so they're taking data from, depending on what category you're buying, let's use spirits, I'm most familiar there.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting the average retail price, the average amount of units to go out at that price point. Or just in general, those total units, your competitor insight, so you can say, oh, well, Bombay did 10,000 bottles in total wine in Kentucky, but Hendrix did 15,000, and the average price was this and this. And so then you can start doing regression analysis on those price points and say, okay, well, if we're looking at it from a revenue management lens, where should we actually be priced at in the market? Like, oh, when we notice that through regression, if we drop our price $5, when Hendrix is at $29.99 and we're now at the same price as them, we steal a ton of share. And we see a rate of sale increase of like 10, whatever it is.
That's so interesting because, and it just clicked for me. So I've worked for two very similar, like same industry, same niche in the industry companies. Mm-hmm. One was very large, one was very small. Mm-hmm. The large one, they, like, we had all this data in our database that we had access to pull, mm-hmm. and it was market rates for Indiana, just Ohio, all these different states, and then it was like average pay rates per specialty, per state, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I was always like, oh, you know, this is just data that's like out there. And it never really clicked for me, like, where did they get this data? It was probably through something like that. Mm-hmm. And I go to the smaller company and they don't have all the data. Right. And it probably because, you know, smaller company, they're not going to pay that much money for all that stuff. So I kind of thought that, you know, as a leader going into there, I would thought, you know, I'd have access to that data to provide for the people at the company. Turns out, that data was nowhere to be found. So that's very interesting.
Yeah, and you know, we're talking externally with that kind of data, right? Nielsen and Circana, whoever else you want to purchase, Numerator, VIP. But when you're small, and going back to the accounting piece and how it all kind of ties in, you can't afford it. So you have to rely on your internal data, as do big companies, and big companies have a lot of the resources for really strong accounting. But you have to look at your accounting team as your master data team. And what I mean by master data is these people create the hierarchy of your data, right? So product groups, subgroups of the products, size, how much inventory you have, how often you're selling, who you're selling to. Always really where those people live, right? Not even just who it is, but like where they live, where your customers live, where do they interact, what industry your customers are in. So your accounting team becomes that. And so if you don't have a really strong accounting partner to help you get as clean of data as possible for your own business, both from like sales data, but also from building a chart of accounts that's actually digestible, that's super important. And so that's part of our services, what we do is accounting. Advantage Point is accounting. And it's not just the basic bookkeeper. We go one step above. That's why we don't call it bookkeeping. And we perform management consulting as well. You know, you're talking like revenue management, like I was saying, so helping you figure out your pricing and promotional strategy. And if we don't have access to Nielsen data, we would do field surveys and work to understand, because you don't have to have external data to make informed.
So you're going to use the data that they have or willing to purchase. Like you're not going to go purchase data for them. It's like, hey, here's what we got. Here's the state of the business. Come in, consult for us, help us with our accounting. Let's start being profitable or move. Mm-hmm. Like maybe we're spending too much money here, but they don't recognize that they could move that over here. That's what you help.
Yeah, I mean, with that one part of management consulting, 100%, because it's not just saying what price point should you be at. We start looking at, like, I have a client now, and we're helping them redesign their P&L. I'm their fractional CFO, so my business
Vantage Point. Define fractional CFO for our listeners.
Yeah, so we operate underneath fractional CFO, management consulting, and accounting. And so a fractional CFO is a part-time CFO. Chief Financial Officer. So we're going to help you manage your finances in a much more routine basis. So we work with you every single month and we help you decide what money you should use, how you should deploy it, right? Do we buy the let's say you're a construction business. Do we buy the forklift or do we rent it? If we buy it, what's the ROI on that, right? Like, how do we make it profitable for us? If you're a startup business, you know, what does our balance sheet look like? Do we have too much debt? Do we not have enough debt? Like, how do you manage your equity and debt mix? And then also project out, you know, your sales and help you understand, like, okay, if I'm going to be at 10,000 units in 2 years, I need $1 million in capital today. So I need to go find $1 million. We help build your investor deck. We help get you in front of capital. We help them negotiate.
So I feel like a lot of people that are in, like you watch Shark Tank, you know? Like, a lot of people in a position that, like, maybe they have a great product and they're running out of money, or they don't really know. Like, a lot of times they'll take or they'll actually give away a larger portion of their company than they probably wanted to because they just wanted access to it. Yeah. And they didn't maybe have the negotiation skills on the spot that maybe a company like Vantage Point's going to provide.
Yeah, and, you know, in my previous lives, at Southern and Bacardi, my job was to negotiate pricing and margins and profit for each company. and where we should be within the guardrails for a given price or for a given product's pricing, and what, how much should we pay the distributor for that price, and all those different things. And so it's obviously different. It's not the same as, you know, structuring an investment deal, but the principles of negotiation are all the same. And so you're looking to be fair. You're looking to be collaborative. You know, what is your black swan, right? What's that one like piece that everything hinges on, the black swan of your negotiation? And so we help them understand, like, okay, not only do you need to negotiate on this, but like, what's the market tell you too? Like, oh, if you're saying 1% equity is worth 200,000, is that realistic? Maybe, maybe not. We need to go help you figure that out. Mm. Oh, does your balance sheet make sense for that kind of investment too? Like, are you even worth that? Or do you have enough like long range potential to be worth it? Or I have a client now where we're helping them structure their entire business and their 10-year plan. And we're not their fractional CFO, but we consult on them through product commercialization. So bringing the product to life and then helping them understand like how it fits in the commercial world, right? So positioning in the shelf, what customers to be in, what price it should be at, what it should be. That's from my time in innovation when I worked at Bacardi and Southern. And so
basically it sounds like you're, as you should, piecing together everything that you've learned from all these other companies, yeah, whether they were shitty companies or whether they were good companies to you. And now you're like almost a superpower, and your wealth of knowledge that now it's equating actually, yeah, to being able to provide this service to others. And I think that is an exciting place to be.
It's so exciting, man. I look back and, you know, not every company was a drab to work at, or not every team either. I mean, like, I learned so much at every single company, and I have a really unique skill set. And it's funny because I had the realization the other day when I put in my resignation for my current employer.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh shit. Like, I just said,
that's big time.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, you don't have a W-2 lined up, and you know, it's like, okay, I got to figure out how to make all this money.
Yeah.
And then I realized, everything I've ever done in my life, but especially in my corporate track record, has been guiding me to this moment. Mm-hmm. And I have such a unique skill set as a result, that it only makes sense. Like, I wanted to be in sales for so long. I love sales. I think it's the best thing ever.
Yeah,
it's so fun. It's sexy. You get to have the dinners and the drinks and you travel and all the fun things. And that's why I like commercial finance, because right, you got a little bit of that, but you weren't as in the weeds as I wanted to be. But because of my time in those commercial roles, I realized, like, when I went to apply for the sales roles and I kept getting turned down, like, I would be frustrated. And then now that I've had my business, I'm like, had I gone into the sales role, I couldn't do what I do now. Could I do something else? Of course.
Right.
Everyone has a marketable skill. It's finding it. But now that I have had so many different roles in finance across three different industries, or, you know, two major industries, but three different sections of those industries, different products, different people you work with, and each role has different teams they work with in there. Like, I don't really work on innovation at Galderma, but I do with customer service, and I'm really heavy on gross to net accounting and like sales forecasting, all this stuff. I don't do the actual forecasting with them.
So you're still involved in sales too.
Yeah.
One thing you said about the sales, like, I think there's two sides of it, right? Mm-hmm. It really depends on the company, because I'm in sales, mm-hmm, and there has been times when I've been selling at a really high clip. And that's great, especially financially, and, you know, for, mm-hmm, you know, morale, for leadership viewing you in a positive light.
For sure.
But what I found is that, and it's not their fault, if I was a business owner, I would do the same thing. When you sell at a high clip like that, and you're the best at what you do, mm-hmm, or even up there and to the close to the best at what you, yeah, do, then leadership will want to have you just do that one thing all the time.
Yeah.
So then you kind of realize, like, as you're maturing and growing, that you're not actually being poured into my goal is to be an entrepreneur down, mm-hmm, the road. And, you know, I have been an entrepreneur a few times before. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of the end goal for me. And so I really love sales in the meantime. So I want to, mm-hmm, be poured into on the business aspect, right? Yeah. So now I start working with a startup. Mm-hmm. And so this is a perfect opportunity, right, for anyone, if you are in sales and you want to learn about actual business and entrepreneurship and how to get a business off the ground, yeah, stuff like that. Working for a startup is a whole different thing, because now you're planning on wearing many hats and doing a lot of different things, but your main thing is sales, right?
Yeah.
But you still, like, it's impossible to not be poured into by the leadership whenever the leadership is in the office next to you, not in a different sector of the business because it's so big.
Right, it is. And I don't blame you for wanting to work in a startup if you really want that entrepreneurial experience, because, and you're coming into a well-funded startup too. So it's very different from, like, you know, I work with some clients who are not well-funded, and you see them scrambling at a tussle, hustle, hustle every day, and they're pouring everything into this business. Mm-hmm. And then where you're at, it's like, that's still happening, but you're past that initial, like,
you got breathing room.
You have breathing room. You know, when you're starting it, it's a little bit different, but you get to see such really great insight of, like, you're probably talking to legal, you're probably talking to accounting, you're talking to your business intelligence team, if there is one, marketing's right there with you.
Yeah.
So you really get in operations, and so you're really ingrained in how the business forms, and you start to understand, like, I can tell you from my own experience starting my business, and I grew up with an entrepreneur as a mother and a dad, and so they had a construction business, they were GCs, and my mom has had a thrift shop forever, and my mom and her family did Little Caesars for a long time, and they had their own business before that. So they're immigrants, you know, the whole thing. So but you don't know until you're in it, and you start understanding, like, you got to worry about legal stuff, and you kind of become like your own little mini lawyer. And then you start thinking about, okay, marketing, like,
yeah, stuff you don't think of. And then you have to start it somehow. So you're learning a little bit there.
Yeah.
And then I feel like too, with like the entrepreneurship side, whether it's a startup or maybe maybe at least you have some mentors or something. In my situation, I see this startup, right? And mm-hmm. I'm like part of it is, yeah, it's great. I get to learn, you know, build something, be a part of something on the ground floor. Mm-hmm. But the motivation doesn't just come from money and stuff like that. Sure, that is a part of it. Mm-hmm. But when I see a CEO, a founder, a VP, whatever, like, it has to work for them, right? Yeah. They don't want to fail. And when I see that kind of passion, I'm like, you know what? If it's not for me, I want to blow this thing up for them. I see their drive. I see that they have a family counting on this. I see that stuff.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful to even just be a part of the building process, not just for me and mm-hmm. my finances, but for them and their families and their futures, which will turn into, when you have that kind of point of view, typically, God makes it to where you're getting some benefit down the road as well, right?
Yeah, and you know, because you learn so much, it's better than any MBA ever could be. You know, I have an MBA. I did that. It was an online through Morehead where I went to undergrad, and it was a check-the-box one, but you still learned a lot. Because my role at the time had seen so many different things as an analyst on a small team, sales, finance, intelligence, marketing, supply chain. I got a lot out of my MBA at an early mm-hmm. age. Not everyone does.
Right.
Building a business, best MBA ever. You're going to learn about filing your taxes. You're going to learn about legal stuff, accounting, negotiating things, marketing, building a sales strategy, building a vision, productizing what you're doing. And that's so incredibly important. And when you're saying about working for an entrepreneur or close to one, dude, I love my client. I mean, almost all of them are entrepreneurs, or they're like, you know, second generation, like, management teams. And just the passion behind their business. And like, these people are fucking brave, dude. They're so brave. It takes balls to do what they do.
Yeah.
And
that's why when they make it, you see Lamborghinis driving around and the license plate says 2.0 CEO.
Yeah.
Because they got a 2.0 GPA in school and they just had the balls to go do it and figure it out and get the MBA in the real world, right?
It's true. It to me, it's just fascinating. And I love talking to them. Like, one of my clients, they were not a single mother. They had like four kids, or maybe even five. I can't remember. She had quite a few, but they were really young. And she was a sales rep. And then she's like, you know, she got an opportunity to buy this business, a printing business. And she ran it and like worked her ass off. Like went to bed at like 2 a.m. as a mom, driving the kids around, cooking dinner, still having, you know, trying to build the business. And they sold it for 7 figures and made a killing. And this is back in the 90s, I would say. So that's really good money.
Then. Yeah, and
really
if they good invested money. That, then they're sitting pretty and, for life.
You know, and she went on another entrepreneurial journey, and she's on another one now. And it's like, it's so cool to just even talk to her and get and pick her brain and see how much she does. And she's just a multi.
Well, and it's funny how you realize, because a lot of people that are not entrepreneurs, they think, oh, I'd like to be an entrepreneur maybe once, cash in, and then just live life and travel. Mm-hmm. But you see time and time again, these entrepreneurs, they're glad that they got the monetary benefit. But for them, that's a means to the next.
For sure.
It's not like, and a lot of them, they're wearing a Timex. Like, they don't really care. Like, you know, they might treat themselves sometimes, but it's about the chase. It's not about the financial monetary benefit from all of this.
Michael, I'll tell you, I'm already ready for the next challenge. You know, Vantage Point's not even fully, I mean, it's off the ground because I'm going full time, and in May 31st is my last official day at Galderma. But I mean, I'm really transitioning in March, April timeframe. But I can't wait for my next entrepreneurial journey. Is it owning a bar or restaurant? I mean, I know it's a red flag because my parents did it, and it was hell for them and all their cousins.
But maybe you can do it, right?
Yeah, maybe. Or, you know, maybe I do it in a different way where it's like, to me, it's just a passion project. Or maybe I design a coffee brand, or maybe I design a...
We need to talk
a shoe brand, you know? Yeah, I think it'd be cool. I think I've always wanted to go in the actual like product side of things because you get to be such an artist and
especially
a creator.
If you're passionate about whatever the product is, yes. It's like perfect. That's why a podcast for me, I wish it had more monetary benefit up front, but it doesn't. You know, maybe we'll get there, but at the same time, like, that's like having a product that you love, like, even if it's a tangible product, it's the same concept because this is... I get to have these conversations, and every single time I do an episode, I learn so much. And people don't understand how much they have to offer until they offer it.
Oh, 100%. I love to see the idea come to life, and that's really what I want to focus on. Like, and that's what we're doing now with Vantage Point and the rebrand, working with a branding agency, second one, we had to fire the first, our web developer, our photography that we just did, and it's just been so cool seeing it, like, this art come into business, and it's this super... cool experience. Yeah. I love it, man.
You heard it here first. Vantage Point Consulting Group.
Yeah, there you go.
You're going to see him on NASDAQ one of these days.
I hope. That's cool. The goal, man.
This episode is sponsored by DieFit. DieFit is a faith-based clothing brand rooted in Christ and built on consistency, structure, and personal growth. DieFit's mission is to help people show up stronger in their faith, their health, and their daily lives. Check out their collection today at die-fit.printify.me.
Super nice, though, and just, like, friendly and genuine.
Yeah. Yeah, she's certainly a... You know, I thought I was a good guy until I met her, and I was like, I got work to do.
That's good. That's good, yeah. You know? Makes you realize, like, there's growth left for you.
Oh, I already knew that. Yeah. Don't worry, brother. I just didn't know how much. Yeah. All right, man. Well, thanks for sharing about your business. That's incredibly cool. I want to move into, like I do on every episode, faith and mental health.
For
so,
sure.
One, just talk to me about your faith. I really kind of want to hear about, like you were talking about how your experiences at each company now set you up for the man that you are now and the opportunity that you have now to do this business. And I couldn't help but think, how much of that would you credit God for?
Yeah, because, I mean, I got to give him all the glory. You know, I grew up in the church, so I'm Lutheran. Okay. And those who don't know Lutheran, it's basically Catholic light. So you don't have a pope, but you do everything else minus confession too.
You say Catholic light?
Yeah, Catholic light, L-I-T-E. Yeah.
So like Miller version. Light versus Miller High Life.
Yeah, it's Bud Heavy versus Bud Light kind of
right.
thing.
That's a better one. Yeah.
And we drink. As Lutherans, we drink. So we're right there.
Wait, is Lutheran the one where, like... Because I remember I went to this church one time. Sorry, we're going on.
No, it's good.
But I remember I went to this church one time, and it was like a friend's church growing up. And I think I was like 12 or something. And I go up to do communion. I just grab a thing, and I drink it. And I'm like, that's not grape juice. That's not Mott's grape juice. Yeah. Is that the
Morgan David wine is like the pretty standard one. It's like really sweet, like red wine.
Why did they not stop a 12-year-old from drinking the wine?
It's the blood of blood of Christ. So it's good for you. Yeah. You know?
Fair enough.
You know, so if you get to a real fancy Lutheran church, you're gonna have white wine or red wine, you choose.
Wow.
Don't know why they feel the need to differentiate, but they do. So yeah, I grew up in the church and I feel like my relationship with God is ebbs and flows, you know, as any relationship's going to ebb and flow. But I leaned on him a lot during my time. I mean, I'll never forget, like, when I was in New York City, like Wall Street, literally 20 years old, interviewed for Deutsche Bank and then didn't get the job. And I was just like, why God? Like, what is going on?
Mm-hmm.
And so over time, I kind of like, you know, I could brush it off quickly and other opportunities that came through, but like, I mean, he's always provided for me. And every opportunity is truly like not rejection, but redirection towards what God has in store for you. I do genuinely believe that. And so it's hard to always trust him and everything. You know, you, as a human, you kind of forget like he's going to take care of you. But then Romans 5:6 is, I believe, at just the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. And that,
say that again.
At just the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. Yeah. And I could botch that, but it's the gist. Okay, it's pretty similar, nearly verbatim. And the reason I love that verse so much is because it just reminds me of God's timing is perfect. Mm-hmm. It's just the right time. Just the right time. And so when I look back on my career and it's like, why did he let me get nearly fired from Bacardi and like shake my confidence like that in myself and go through really tough times at Southern and, you know, at Bacardi, like literally it was so bad at one point I cried to my boss. Like I hadn't cried at work in 5 years.
Yeah.
And here I am like literally on the call to my boss and like this place eats my soul crying, you know, and like mental health problems and all that stuff. So, but you just learn like, it was always supposed to happen that way, and he was always there in every single moment, whether it was a bright moment or a super dark one, and you go through things, and they're super important for your development. And I know, you know, from the podcast I listened to, Pastor Paul, shout out to him, he's no longer with us, but I still listen to his podcast, and he's like, you can't just say everything is like God's like will, because it's not everything is, but I still, like, I think it's not everything happens for a reason, like he doesn't like that terminology. But I still look at it as though, like, he got you through whatever you went through.
And it led you to whatever it is. Like,
yeah.
And I think that's where the free will comes in, right?
Because for sure.
You've got free will. So, you know, I can go botch relationships, be arrogant, just anything that God doesn't want me to do. I can go do that.
Yeah.
And then the minute I seek him again, he's actually just been waiting at the door.
For
and
sure.
And he's like, all right, created this mess. But I got you. Let's kind of move this way. And it's like all those can turn into positives. Mm-hmm. It's just unfortunately sometimes for people that never actually end up seeing that light or getting that back, it can be harder. For sure.
It can be super hard. And, you know, when my most recent connection to God for the whole business side of things was the day I put in my resignation, like they had, was asked officially to submit it so they could go and hunt for my backfill so I could go and train them when they get hired before my official termination date. And I submitted my resignation and it didn't really hit me. And then that night I was working on client stuff. It was late and it just dawned on me as I'm like logging out for the day. Like every single thing in my life has led me to this moment, and God has been, you know, pulling the strings to get me to where I needed to be. Like I could have been an investment banker. I could have gone to Deutsche. I could have been in sales had I really tried, but he just pulled me right away, you know, right along to where I needed to be. And then I was like, if he brought me here and I truly feel like this is my calling. And, you know, again, Pastor Paul's like, people, you're called to things. You should go pursue them. If you're called to them, you feel convicted that you should be a business owner or, you know, a firefighter, whatever it is, you need to pursue that. That's God telling you that that's what you're supposed to be doing and serving him in that nature. And so he's going to provide. Like, if he calls you to it, he will provide. And, you know, my anxiety around like, oh, you know, I'm taking a pay cut to go do this opportunity. And like how long, I have enough money to survive for a little bit, but it still concerns me because it's not cheap to live, not just in Miami, but in general. And so I'm just putting it back on God of like, if he has called me to this and it has been growing and people have been raving about our services and I have clients, all my clients are word of mouth. I mean, we've done barely any marketing and like everyone loves us when they sign up with us. It's been fantastic, been really blessed, but that just means he's going to provide. And, you know, I've been praying a lot about, like, God, I need two more clients to make sure I don't have to take a pay cut. Like, please.
Well, and it's those specific prayers, too.
Yeah.
And I feel like when you do get specific and you're not just asking God broadly, like, hey, can you help me out?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, he will, but I've found that as soon as I get a little more specific in my prayers, it's like, because you're not asking for too much at that point. You're not saying, hey, give me 30 clients. I want to get rich quick.
Right.
You're saying, God, to make ends meet and to keep doing my passion,
Here's
financially what I would need to do that.
Yes.
Here's the means. Can you help me get there? And I feel like just in my experience, that has been received so much better in the return that God gives me because I'm like, I feel better about it too because I feel like I had humility in coming to him in a way that was also humble.
Yeah, you know, it is humbling yourself before God and asking for what you need. Because it's hard. I mean, life is really hard. You can't do it on your own. Especially some of these major initiatives you're going through in life, right? Whether it's a business, trying to start a family, trying to buy a home, whatever, like you need, you know, prayer. And I know not everybody's religious, but it just helps to have someone to believe in and know that like you can trust them, right? And that's just, you know, God, I believe in him more than that, but that can be an opportunity for a lot of people. So
yeah,
I find a lot of value in having faith. And, you know, people ask a lot of questions now because of like, you know, you grew up in Kentucky and like everything that's going on with the Republican and Democrat and stuff. And like, how do you rationalize either political party? And it's like, you just be a good person, really. You know, it's like God would never, you know, not accept somebody or not be... He just wants the best for everybody, and he doesn't turn away from people. So if you have any problems, and the reason I bring that up is because if you have any problems in any part of your life, he's there. Mm-hmm. You know, it is your dad, really. Like, yeah. That's how you should view it. You should view it literally as your father, like someone who doesn't turn their back on you, someone you can trust. Who
unconditional has love, yeah.
Unconditional love, yeah. So, you know, that's a little bit about my journey with faith.
Yeah, and tell me how... however you want to put it about, you know, any mental health stuff you've gone through, any depression, anxiety stuff, and maybe how that tied in with your faith as well.
Yeah. You know, it's tough because when I've had like pockets of mental health issues. Like we talked about earlier, like, you know, in fifth grade, you know, I remember like in the shower, like making like, you know, suicide notes in my head and that kind of thing. And
fantasizing about suicide
and everything. And then it would, you know, was better in middle school, but I was like an angry middle schooler, I think. You know, you're a lot of hormones going on, and then bullying and that kind of thing. And then high school.
Were you bullied a lot?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Definitely. And high school, similar. But like, I think I found like a better group in high school. And then college, I didn't really have like a lot of mental health problems, I don't think, in high school. I think it kind of subsided a little bit. And then college, it was great that first year, right? I mean, have an amazing time your freshman year. It can happen, but I had a great time. I felt like I was free, and like I could start over, and I had this fresh, I could reinvent myself, you know, like no one knows me. I went to school in Moorhead. No one knew me in Moorhead. So I could be whoever I wanted to be. I could be the dude who is super into business, or I could be the guy who wanted to play intramural sports every day, or I could be the guy who wanted to just gym and drink and do whatever. So I could just be me. No one knew me. No one had a preconceived notion of me.
And do you think, I think kind of what's calling me right now, you said the bullying thing.
Yeah.
Do you think, I'm trying to see maybe how that kind of tied in. I do get that. Like I felt the same way to some degree in college. It's like, no one knows me. But I feel like there's also a piece there where, the bullying, like whether it was specific things all the time, like the same thing, or whether it was different things, like those things, I feel like, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of listeners who have dealt with bullying.
For sure.
You know? And I just wonder on those times when you're bullied over and over for certain things, it's like how much of that plays a factor into like just the excitement for the opportunity to reinvent yourself potentially like in college, because everyone has that to a level where it's like, hey, this is cool, I can do this. But if you've got that traumatic experience and now you have an opportunity, I can see that being like Christmas morning.
Yeah, I mean, it really was. And then I think that's why, like, even moving to Miami now, it's like, I'll get to reinvent myself again. And so, and then even moving from Moorhead back to Louisville, I get to reinvent myself again because I've been away for 3 years and I can come back as somebody different. Why would you not be different after college? Mm-hmm. Especially when you don't go to a school in your hometown.
Do you ever find yourself trying to be different when you come back to a place or go to a place because maybe you felt some insecurities on how you left?
It's interesting because I actually talked about this in therapy recently about like, am I a chameleon and I just adapt to the area that I'm living in and the friend group I'm with, or and like I don't have any genuine aspect about me, or is it more so like, oh, like the area I'm in calls for me to be, or people to be in a certain way. Like, would I wear cowboy? Do I wear like my Tecovas in Miami? No, not really. But is it because I don't feel, it just like it's too hot, you know?
Yeah.
And it's also not really the vibe, but like I have like Miami poppy shirts and like, you know, like little like a Cuban kind of vibe. And you know, you're wearing a little bit more like tropical stuff, but that wouldn't really work in Kentucky.
Because viewed as cultural.
Cultural, yeah.
Yeah, maybe not so much, it could be chameleon. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's how it started, but maybe now it's like, hey, you came to Texas today, you're going to wear some ostrich boots. That's absolutely. Pretty cool.
And the suede jacket, because you got to fit in.
Right, yeah.
But
clean.
Yeah. So I think from a personality perspective, it's more like those people met me in different parts of my life. And I was in a different stage at all those different places. Or, you know, places, Louisville to, or Shepherdsville to Moorhead to Louisville to Miami, you know. So you just have, because you're in different spots, you learn different things, and you have a different perspective, and you meet new friends, and you just kind of change. And I think overall, my brand is me, and people know I think everyone has a different side of themselves. Like, I know you as Michael right now, but Allie knows a different side of you than I know of you, because she's your girlfriend. And your friends from high school, they know you from Michael from high school up to now, if they're still your friend. Same thing for mine. So,
unfortunately, I wish most of them knew the Michael now instead of the Michael then.
Me too, but to be honest. I feel I've seen so much. I've really grown a lot as a person. And I've put a lot of effort into growing, like self-help books, therapy, podcasts, traveling the world or traveling the country as much as you possibly can, being open to new ideas, like... Yeah, I think you have to be. And so...
Well, and I feel like, therapy is great. And I feel like just therapy and getting older and having new experiences shows you a lot about yourself and your past. And it's like, I do feel sorry for that kid or, you know, that guy, whatever stage of life it was. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you could, like, identify that and, you know, be like, if I could just show you this or give you a hug here. Because I feel like what I used to do, like, I had some really tight people in my life. Like after college, right? And I started going through some stuff mentally, and looking back, it was really sad because I think I looked at it as like, whenever I was on the other side of that, they were nowhere to be found. But that may have been true on the surface over time, but in order for them not to be found, it took a lot of mental beating for me to where it was like, I thought everyone should cater to my mental health, to all that stuff. And then looking back, I'm like, it's almost like too far gone to do an apology, right? But it's like just kind of like, I wish you could know how sorry I am for that.
Maybe
they're listening. Probably not, but maybe.
And I think too, you know, I used to put a lot of pressure in, I think like internally, I'm like, well, my friends aren't there for me and I'm in like this time of need. Mm-hmm. And I'd reach out to them and they wouldn't answer or whatever. But it's not their responsibility. And that took me a long time to get there. Because you know, when you're best friend, it's like, they should be there for me. And so that's why getting into therapy has really helped, because it's like that person is literally paid to be there for you. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, just allowed me to give grace to people in my life who I thought I needed, and they're like, I'm just your friend. Like, I don't know how to like give you professional advice on things you're going through. You know what I'm saying?
Kind of what I'm getting alluded to.
How do you, if they don't have this, it's like asking me to be your electrician. That'd be the dumbest thing you could ever do.
Yeah. I'll sit there and watch you do it, but I don't really know. But.
Yeah. Like, you know, I'm like, I know wires connect to like boxes out in the yard.
Yeah.
You know, that's about it. And they connect to like light switches and stuff. But so I can give you like my thoughts, but they might not be accurate. Maybe I get lucky. I'm like, yeah, the blue wire connects out there and it connects here and you're good. But
yeah,
actually going to therapy finally after all those years has been really helpful. And so I think what kind of got me started on that like mental health journey is really, I mean, post-college, I was listening to Nikki Glaser, the comedian.
Yeah.
I love her. She's hilarious. But I listened to her when she had, what's the radio show? Serious show. So I listened to her when she had a serious show and it transitioned to a podcast, but she is really big on mental health and like therapy and all this stuff. And so I learned a lot through her.
She is.
Huge on therapy.
Wow. Man. Yes. I would have not thought that. Because usually like the people... I feel like a lot of comedians... maybe I'm wrong, because you got Theo Vaughn, you've got Joe Rogan, and I feel like all those really good comedians were in dark, dark places, and they're like still thriving as comedians decades later because they actually worked on their mental health.
And you know, a lot of like
funny thing.
The comedy's also shielding the trauma, and like that was me too. Like, you know, I would say, like, I mean, I think I'm funny. I think most of my friends think I'm kind of funny, at least. And so I would use that humor of like to shield or like kind of make light of how I was actually feeling. Like I used to say, I'll just kill myself a lot. And that was like, but for a while it was kind of like a joke, you know? And then when I was in Miami, and I was like all alone and I was going through like I had moved to a new city and didn't know anybody. And my boss was not supportive and the company wasn't supportive. And then the work turned to shit like right away when I moved there, and I didn't have a social net in terms of like a community of friends. And then I went through some dating troubles, like a couple dates, and I was like putting a lot of hope on the one lady I was seeing, and that fell through, and I took it really hard. And I'm just like super depressed. I'm just like, I should just kill myself. But before that, like my mind would not stop saying kill yourself. Like from the moment I woke up to the moment I went to bed, it just says it all day. And like that's a really dark spot to be in. And you people who don't suffer through mental health, like don't understand, you just can't shut that off. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, people think, dude, I mean, just go like work out or something. It's like, yeah. But when I do, I come back and I feel the same.
Exactly.
The exact same as I did before. So it's like, I feel like that's that threshold where it's like, did I have a bad day and have a thought of it? Or like you alluded to earlier, like, was I really kind of thinking like, how would that be? How would that happen? Like, and I think that that's when you kind of toe those, I guess you're kind of going into very dark waters for that sure. You don't really know how to navigate. And if you go too far in, it's going to take a lot to pull you out.
Yeah, and I used to go to the gym, like you said, like and that was my solution. I would do cardio all the time. Like I would run a 5K. This is in college especially, like a 5K every single day. Because of the endorphin high, right? Like that's basically the only thing I was doing to avoid like dealing with my problems, literally running away from them, which plays into attachment theory, which you can talk about.
Yeah.
Very avoidant personality on, especially in dating, which is thankfully a lot better now. But, you know, then I started dating and that relationship really helped me, but it was, had a lot of ups and downs. And so when that ended, it ended amicably, which is great. But and we decided to stay friends. But I went to therapy because it was no longer Thomas can't rely on going to the gym because I wasn't doing that like I used to. And Thomas can't rely on not talking about it. He can't claim it's money anymore because he has the money to pay for it. He can't, you know, turn to his friends because they don't understand. They're not equipped to help you with those problems. They're all a basket case too, you know. Mm-hmm. They're not trained.
It's funny how selfish we are when we look back too, because we're like, "Oh, well, my stuff is so big. Like, I have all these mental health problems," and then you think like I said, you cater to my needs.
Yeah,
and it's crazy because you see how selfish that is. Because just because they don't have the mental health problems and the depression and stuff, that doesn't mean that they don't have a whole other slew of issues that you don't have. That just is in a different realm of things. But we're so locked into ourselves sometimes. And it's honestly sick too when you look back. You're like, maybe I was sick. Mm-hmm. Like actually maybe
sick. You for sure are. You for sure are sick. And people don't understand it if they've never been in that spot.
One of the opinions that I have about mental health is that we view it like something that's... You know, you're an outcast if you have deep mental health issues or something like that. Whereas really, I feel like we need to view it as like the person who has cancer, right?
For sure.
If you have cancer and you can't help but have that cancer, people say, "Oh, Tom, are you okay? Yeah. I'm going to be there for you throughout the chemo and everything like that." That's wonderful, right? But why don't we view that in mental health the same way, to where it's like, whether it's addiction, like, hey, I have a really bad drug problem. I didn't mean to get hooked on this stuff. We talked about that in an episode that I'll release here soon. Is like, I didn't wake up one day and say, hey, I want to be an addict today. You know, I think I just want to like do this and then like be hooked on it.
Right.
Or wake up and say, I think anxiety and depression sounds like something I want to have for a while, right?
Yeah. You know, I think a big part of it, and obviously I'm like no mental health expert, but you can, it's tangible, cancer's tangible. Like the person loses their hair, they become very frail, they can become very sick, and they lose all this weight and everything. I mean, the same can be said to a degree with depression, right? Because it kind of eats you alive. You know, you don't really go out as much, you... you know, wither away in bed, or you know, you become more withdrawn. So, you know, there are some physical pieces to it, but I think people understand the lethality of cancer, and they understand that, oh, there's a path to get better. You take your medication and you go to chemo and then you get better. If you don't, then that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas depression, it's just change your mind. Like, okay, well, I would love to do that. Like, I would love to not have those thoughts. What do you mean? I don't want to kill myself. No one, yeah. no one sane wants to kill himself. Your body, your mind is truly against you.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is the, unfortunately, like, and I know, like, I'm glad that there's cry for help. So I think it's frowned upon to have a cry for help. So I want to mention that. Like, hey, I just took a bunch of Tylenol or something like that. Mm. You know, someone could think that that might do something bad to them, and it's not good for you, but
right.
it's, you're probably not going to pass away from something like that. Mm-hmm. And I feel like when something like that happens, everyone says, oh, that was just a cry for help. Right. They didn't really want to do that. It's like, why are you saying that then? Mm-hmm. Of course, it's a cry. You just literally said it's a cry for help. So why don't we provide some help? Instead of this whole like, oh, they're crazy because, you know, they just wanted people to know that. It's like they wanted them to know that for a reason, probably. Mm-hmm. And then there's the part where, you know, you really do want to hurt yourself.
Yeah.
And your mind tells you something like, no, this is actually good. Like, this is maybe what God once, like, God didn't design this world to be for everyone, so like, I'm just going home, or, you know, right. something like that. And I think that's where, like, a lot of people experience that, to where it's like total mind trickery rationale,
for sure,
to where you actually truly believe mm-hmm. that if you were to not be here, it would be totally fine, like, you, everyone would be better, and yeah. you would be better, so like, why not? Like,
yeah, well, I mean, I think part of it's like when the call is coming from inside the house, you know, people are, it's like even scarier, because like, why would you decide to take an action that would potentially end your life or whatever? And like, how do you, on the outside looking in, it's like, well, how do you even approach that person? Like, I don't, it's very scary, because like, oh, I can just give you to a doctor, like, oh, wait, let's take you to the doctor's office, let's take you to the hospital if you're physically sick, like, oh, you know, we'll give you the medicine, and they it becomes logical, the steps that need to be done to mm-hmm. heal that person. Where I think, again, no expert, but with mental health, because it doesn't have this prescription of like, and there are prescriptions now, but it can go so extreme, and it's your own mind against you, where like, you know, maybe it's a virus or a bacteria on the outside that comes into your body and makes mm-hmm. you sick, and people understand that, but they can't understand like, well, just change it. Like, it's, you're causing it, you know?
It's the unseen. So it's like, and that's why faith scares people, right? Mm-hmm. The opposite of that would be true faith in something good.
Yeah.
But you actually have to have true faith that something bad is going on. And that's where people, and I don't think people really, your average person doesn't mean bad by this, mm-hmm. but they just, their mind doesn't want to understand. Mm-hmm. And so, unfortunately, you get looped into this category of, you're unstable. Now maybe I should stay away. Mm-hmm. And I think what's really cool, and I've seen a trend over the last 5-6 years of, at first it was a little bit like in the mental health rehab setting.
Yeah.
It was a little more geared to alcohol, drug, have to have like a substance issue. Mm-hmm. And now there's like plenty of rehabs that will take people simply for depression, you know, suicidal ideation, suicidal attempts,
yeah.
things like that, where it's like, I think a lot of people think it has to exist with substances, and those are the people being treated, when really there's a whole realm of people who maybe they use substances to cope with how they're feeling, but they're not physically hooked, and they're not like true addicts or alcoholics, and now there's places for them to go that will accept them, and insurance will actually pay for it a lot of times now. Yeah.
Well, and we kind of talked about this earlier in the day, but, you know, these mental health today, I think, also has a problem, like, lack of education. It's improved a lot, but, I mean, it stems back to, like, my parents were born in the 60s. You know, when you grow up in that environment of, and, well, I mean, the boomer generation and Gen X, when you grow up in that environment of, oh, if you have any mental health problem, you're, like, kind of a freak. You know, mm-hmm. so you're institutionalized, you're jailed, and you have this serious problem, and that kind of all ties in of like, okay, well, now we don't want to talk about it, people don't know how to, you know, they just want you to get better, because it's like, what happens if you don't, you know? Mm-hmm. And so with these places like you're saying, like, you know, it's a mental health rehabilitation center. I think that kind of helps make it more tangible and more approachable and less stigmatized because, okay, I know if you have an alcohol addiction, you can go to rehab. Or if you have a drug addiction, you can go to drug rehab. And so it's like, okay, I can go and get rehabilitated from a mental health perspective. And now it's not like I'm being institutionalized. I'm actually going to a physical place to get better, like an intensive training kind of thing, or, you know, or like mental like repair center. Mm-hmm. And that makes it, I think, a little bit easier, but it's still, there's still stigma around it for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there is, you know, there's the population that like truly is, you know, addicts, alcoholics, things like that. And then there's the other side of it where a lot of times it is hand in hand, mm-hmm. but it may not be a physical thing or like a need. It's just a coping mechanism. And that's true for everyone, but there is that point for some people where they actually just get hooked. Oh, they're sure. sick without it.
Yeah. I mean, addiction's a scary thing, right? I mean, it really does stem out of, I think most of the time, like trying not to feel what you're actually feeling. Yeah. You know, I know some buddies in my life have definitely turned to pot or to alcohol, and like that's been their way out. And like, oh, I just love like feeling high, whether mm-hmm. it's from weed or from alcohol. And it's like, or, you know, a lot of people do shrooms and everything too, like to escape reality. And cool, I mean, look, I like to smoke weed every now and then. I like to drink and get a buzz, cool. But at a certain point, if you're doing it all the time, something is wrong in your reality and you're escaping it. You're not facing those problems head on. You need to face them head on because obviously there's an issue. Mm-hmm. And the more you suppress it and the more you're avoiding dealing with it, the bigger it's going to become, it's just going to manifest into something much worse, which could typically lead to addiction. Mm. And then now you're double screwed because you already have this mental health problem. Now you have this actual physical problem that's associated with it too. It's usually worse for you because it eats away your liver, or your body, your brain, whatever it is, your teeth, your esophagus, lungs. So, you know, if you're having those problems, you're using a substance, whatever it is, or gambling or whatever, to feel like a different type of reality, I mean, you definitely need to go see help because it's just going to get worse before it gets better.
Yeah. No, and I think that's a good way to close this out.
Yeah.
And I, you know, before we end it, I like to ask every single guest I have on here, for that person that's struggling with mm-hmm. anything we talked about today, it doesn't have to just be the last thing, but that's, you know, on that journey, maybe that they are figuring themselves out. Maybe they don't really see the light. Maybe they know God exists, but doesn't know he's there for them. Mm-hmm. Maybe they are having those bad thoughts and they don't really know what to do about them. And maybe they don't want to reach out to anyone. What would you say to that person?
That's a tough one. I mean, face it head on, you know, reach out to people, invest in yourself, right? I mean, people are afraid to spend $100, the $200 a month or $300 a month for therapy. Go for it. Try it. You might not find the best therapist right away, but it's definitely worth going and actually seeking out help. And it's intimidating, right? Because then you're admitting to yourself you have a problem, you need help. And but think of it as a coach rather than a doctor.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for being on, Tom. Really appreciate you, man.
Yes, thank you.
Lastly, I just want to let you have the opportunity to share with our listeners where to find you for your business. And sure. You have a website or anything like that that you want to share. Yeah,
so you can find us at vantagepoint-usa.com. We also have LinkedIn, Vantage Point Consulting Group. My LinkedIn's Thomas Kurtzinger, Instagram T Kurtzinger, I think 14. So all that'll be linked, and then our website's under construction now. So the new one will be released in about a month or two. Well, I guess depending on when this comes out, about April 1st.
Yeah, it'll be around then.
Okay, so, perfect. Yeah. So by the time this comes out, you guys can go and check out the new website, all the new branding we have going on, and learn more about what we do and who we work with.
Sounds good, man. Thank you.
This episode is sponsored by Tin Can Timepieces. Looking for a watch that's built for anything life throws at you? Let me introduce you to Tin Can Timepieces. This is more than just a watch. It's a commitment to quality and purpose. Tin Can Timepieces is proudly based out of Georgia and is owned and operated by an active duty U.S. Navy submariner. That's right, a company built on discipline and precision. Every watch they create is handcrafted and features reliable automatic movements, ensuring you get a premium quality feel with every tick. Whether you need a rugged diver or a classic dress watch, Tin Can offers an assortment of styles for every mission. Tin Can Timepieces. Hand-built for purpose, built for the depths. Dive deeper and check out their collection today at tincantime.com.